Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Tom Carruthers, who's the author of Uncharted Journeys, Promoting Democracy in the Middle East. He's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and we'll look into President Bush's inauguration address, in which he outlined a foreign policy, essentially, that predicts or depends upon the notion that the United States' security depends upon the liberty, the spread of liberty throughout the world. Other people suggest it is a further embrace of a neoconservative worldview, and the record so far indicates that the Bush foreign policy has actually produced the reverse of liberty and security. So we'll be looking into the President's inauguration address and the new administration, the foreign policy team. We'll also talk with Professor Mazieh Behrouz, who is at San Francisco State University. He's a professor of Middle East history, and we'll be talking to him about the Iranian mention of Iran that the Vice President Cheney mentioned in an interview with Don Imus on radio. He said that Iran was right at the top of the list of potential world trouble spots, and he feared that Israel might well decide to act first without being asked. And we look into an Iranian reaction of the notion that there will be a preemptive removal of Iran's potential nuclear capability. This, of course, follows an article by Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker that said the United States was actively involved in sending reconnaissance teams into Iran to try and locate these secret facilities. So we'll get a sense of how this is playing in Iran and whether the a potential U.S. or Israeli preemptive strike against Iran would sever the mullahs from the people or drive the people deeper into the embrace of the mullahs. We'll also talk with Michael Sells, who's a professor of religion at Haverford College, and he's the author of The New Crusades, Constructing the Muslim Enemy. So we'll get a sense of how the President Bush's inauguration is playing in the Middle East and in the Islamic world, given that there's a rise of Islamic fundamentalism amongst the youth in a lot of the Middle East, particularly in Syria, where the failure of secular government has led to the rise of fundamentalism amongst the youth. So we'll look into the idea that there is this class of civilizations out there in terms of religious fundamentalism, both in terms of Christian fundamentalism and Islamic fundamentalism, on a collision course. I'm speaking with Tom Carruthers, who is an author of Uncharted Journeys, Promoting Democracy in the Middle East. Tom Carruthers is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. And in the President's inauguration address, which many critics, including former speechwriter for President Reagan, Peggy Noonan, suggest that was overtly, the religiosity was over the top. The President, in the speech, mentioned freedom 27 times, liberty 15 times, tyranny 5 times, justice 5 times, God 3 times, threat 2 times, security 1 time, and failed to mention war, Iraq, Iran, or terror. So how would you rate the priorities in the President's speech?
Well, there was only one priority, and that was, as you mentioned, freedom and liberty, which he simply stated over and over and over without developing the idea, not just mentioning not Iran or Iraq. In fact, he never mentioned the name of a single country in the world. And so, I mean, rhetoric has its place in American speech-making and in political life generally, but there comes a point at which rhetoric is so divorced from reality that it becomes counterproductive, and I think we have an instance of that here. It may have been well-received in some parts of the United States, but I have a fairly strong feeling, and indications I've had from conversations I've had with people in different parts of the world in the last few days make it pretty clear that it's not so well-received in other parts of the world.
Hello?
Yes.
It's not being received well in the world.
Yeah, because people are, what they're hearing is an American president holding himself in a sense above the international stage, saying that he and his country are operating at a higher level of principle and have, you know, a landscape of just a sort of a moral vision for the 21st century. Yet these are people still recoiling from the shock of Abu Ghraib and the feeling, and lots of other things, and feeling that, you know, how has the president and the White House and the U.S. government really persecuted those who've done wrong, not just one person, but the whole system that produced this kind of mistreatment of people. And they can't bury failures like that simply with more rhetoric. And so there's a real frustration on the part of a lot of audiences in other countries with a president who refuses to acknowledge past mistakes, refuses to take the corrective measures to really make sure those mistakes don't happen again, yet then just ladles on another heavy dose of the rhetoric and feels great about it.
Well, clearly there's a gulf between rhetoric and reality. If you look at the results of the apparent intentions, for example, of the intervention in Iraq, if the intervention in Iraq was meant to take the pressure off Israel, to secure Saudi oil, to bring democracy to the Middle East, and get rid of a tyrant, except for getting rid of the tyrant, they've almost created the opposite. And in fact, the tyrant's henchmen, who apparently were prepared for the American invasion and were prepared for this insurgency, looks like they're going to come back. We're going to end up, at the end of the day, the thugs that we went in there to remove will end up running the place.
Well, it's not clear how Iraq's going to come out, and I suspect the Iraqi people may end up with a somewhat better life. But what there is a denial of the central issue in the war on terrorism, which is that in order to prosecute this war properly, the United States has needed to befriend or make closer friendships with quite a few dictatorial allies in the world, from Pakistan to Uzbekistan to Egypt to Saudi Arabia and other places. And for the president to recast this war on terrorism, which is necessarily rather dark and dirty in some ways, as a broad crusade for freedom, well, you know, Madison Avenue has seen similar campaigns, but it doesn't mean the world has to find this persuasive. What they see is an America acting in a very realpolitik way, interpreting international law in the ways that it wants, dismissing it when it needs to, making deals with dictators when it needs to, and in some cases invading countries like Afghanistan and Iraq for a mix of security and political reasons, but then packaging it all as though it's this unified, moral, gleaming vision of a crusade to end tyranny. It won't wash.
Well, when we last spoke, you talked about this strange mixture of unilateralism and isolationism in this administration. Where do you stand now in terms particularly given the new lineup, that the people, for example, who advised the president against Iraq in terms of, you know, Colin Powell saying the notion of the pottery barn analogy, if you break it, you own it, and now that the country clearly is broken, and there's some sense that Brent Scowcroft and others are afraid that there'll be a civil war, meaning the country that we went to rescue will cease to be a country. Nevertheless, it's so clear that those voices are out, and the people who engineered this war are in. And you know, the president apparently before this speech, Karl Rove and Michael Gerson and the president met with Charles Krauthammer, Fuad Ajami, Victor Davis Hanson, and other prominent neoconservatives. So where do we stand in terms of this peculiar mix of unilateralism and isolationism?
Well, the president, of course, felt very vindicated in the election, not simply for his own sort of personal stake in the presidency, but for his whole foreign policy. And so what we have now, the new foreign policy team, is simply the old foreign policy team minus Colin Powell. In other words, we have Vice President Cheney, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, and now Secretary of State, or soon to be, Condoleezza Rice. It's really the same team, minus the one person who is a bit of a dissenter. So he's clearly emboldened by the election, not simply in his domestic program, but in his foreign policy as well. Now, they are a little bit chastened by the experience in Iraq, at least in the sense that it's absorbing a much higher level of resources than they anticipated, both financial and diplomatic and just sort of bureaucratic time. Yet they are setting their sights on Iran to some extent, although we have to see, you know, what actually happens. But so far, this has, I'd say, fed the unilateral instinct in this team. And the president's speech indicates that the sort of provincialism or the whatever isolationist streaks may have been present early on in this administration after the 2000 elections are gone.
And what about this, the sort of evangelical tinge there to this speech, the notion a crusade?
Well, this is another thing that really doesn't go down well with foreign audiences, whether it's Europeans who are very just reticent about this kind of mixing of religiosity and politics, or people in the Islamic world who have a very strong sense of Christian fundamentalism playing through the U.S. policy. And so this kind of effort to cast U.S. policy and the U.S. as an actor somehow endowed with special powers or a special mission, I'm afraid it's counterproductive in terms of actually making our presence welcome or well-received in most parts of the world.
And Tom Carruthers, again, you're the author of Uncharted Journey, Promoting Democracy in the Middle East, and a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Earlier, I suggested that this war in Iraq was, for all intents and purposes, lost. It does seem that every day that passes, it gets worse for our soldiers there, and it certainly is not improving the lives of the Iraqi people. Do you feel that this election, whether or not it takes place in any meaningful way, will bring about the results that you suggested, that things may get better? Others like Brent Scowcroft feel that it perhaps may precipitate the contours of a civil war seem to be there already.
Well, the election is a necessary risk. We have to do something to try to start a process of creating an Iraqi government with real legitimacy in the eyes of the Iraqi people. An election is one way to do that, and there is a chance that if this election comes off, even though many Sunnis will not participate, that it will be legitimate in large enough parts of the country that a government can be formed, and this government may have a better ability to try to bring on board some of the moderate Sunnis back into, in a sense, of participation in how the country is being governed. It's a big if, but I think it's a necessary risk because we put ourselves in a box because the current government doesn't really have that kind of legitimacy, at least in some quarters. We need this election, need to try to have it, and in a sense, often in policy, the answer is you shouldn't start from here, but here we are today having put ourselves in the situation. So given that, I think the election is the way to proceed. And I don't think it can get, well, it could get worse, but I think this election will produce the makings of a new government. I think it will really struggle. It may fail about with the civil conflict and not be able to deal with it very well, but at least it will start to be an Iraqi government, not run by a prime minister who used to be a CIA operative.
And will this government be a sufficient fig leaf behind which the United States can begin to withdraw?
I don't think the White House and the Pentagon are eager to withdraw. They would like to see Iraq stabilized. You know, some people are talking about a new government over the next year might call for the United States to engage in some kind of withdrawal, and there are probably some people in the government who'd be happy if they did that. But this is a president who feels the mission is right. He's pretty determined to see it through. He managed it to get reelected, even though it was going pretty badly, so he's not really paying any political price for it at this point. So I don't think they're looking for an excuse to withdraw at this point.
But Tom Carruthers, could it be that he was elected, this wasn't so much a referendum on Iraq, but an indictment of the failure of the opposition, the Democrats, to let the American people know exactly what's going on? I mean,
yeah, that's true, but the American people had the chance to inform themselves about the war, and maybe they came to an inaccurate judgment about it in some people, or in my view, but I think they were informed enough to make their judgment, and the president showed that he made the case for it. I don't happen to agree with that case, but I don't think we can just blame the Democrats. I think we have to say the American people weighed their options, and a majority of them preferred President Bush, knowing full well that he was unrepentant about the war and planning to carry it through in the same style which he's been prosecuting the war to date.
But people who know the region suggest that it would take 5 to 10 years to stabilize the country, and tremendous amount of treasure and presumably a continuing loss of life.
It's true. It's an enormous task. I mean, it has already drained the strength of the U.S. military tremendously. It's cost a huge amount of money. It's hurt us diplomatically in many places. It has created political tensions in the Arab world. This war has had huge costs for, so far, rather tenuous or even absent benefits. But that doesn't mean that this administration isn't determined to just slog ahead. That's their outlook. They believe that this war was a success in the sense of having gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, showed the world that it can't fool around with the United States, and they plan to see it through.
And just in closing, what will the role of Dick Cheney be in this next 4 years, assuming he lasts the 4 years out? Presumably they might want to bring somebody else in to groom them for the next election?
No, I don't think they will. No, I think the bond between the president and the vice president is powerful, and I don't think that they will ease Cheney out at any point. And I think Cheney will play a fundamental role in setting some of the priorities in foreign policy. He's close to the president. You have a fairly... a national security advisor now who's a good man, Stephen Hadley, but I wouldn't say he's a major personality or a major force in the administration. And so you have the vice president closest to the president on a day-to-day basis. He has very strong views about Iran and some other places. So I think we will continue to see Vice President Cheney playing a very important role in the setting of priorities in foreign policy.
And he's essentially joined at the hip with Donald Rumsfeld. They go back a long way.
They do go back a long ways, and they have a fairly similar outlook, I would say. Yes, I think it's much more likely we'd see Rumsfeld leave rather than Cheney.
And Cheney's the first vice president that I've ever heard of that has his own National Security Council, so he does seem to have an inordinate amount of influence.
Well, Vice President, when he was Vice President, Albert Gore did have National Security staff, and it wasn't quite as large or as powerful as Cheney's, but it's Cheney that makes this not. I mean, he does have some advisors, but that's not what's unusual. Mm. What's unusual is the Vice President really playing a senior, I don't quite know the right word, senior counsel role with the president, above and beyond, far above and beyond what Vice President Gore did or other vice presidents in the past.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Tom Carruthers.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking today with Tom Carruthers, who's the author of Uncharted Journey, Promoting Democracy in the Middle East. He's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C. I'm now speaking with Mazia Behrouz, who is a professor of Middle East history at the San Francisco State University. And a few days ago, Vice President Cheney, in an interview with Don Imus's radio show, talked about Iran in terms of it being, prior to this, of course, Condoleezza Rice mentioned Iran as being on top of being a number of the six countries that were beyond the pale. But he also, Vice President Cheney mentioned Iran as being right on top of the list of potential world trouble spots. And he feared that Israel might well decide to act first without being asked. How's this playing inside of Iran? If the intention of the United States is to free the Iranian people from the mullahs, it would seem, just to my mind, that it would have the reverse effect. It would drive the Iranian people deeper into the embrace of the mullahs.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And so far as we can say, freedom and liberation for Iraq has been what? Civil war, disintegration. So if Iranians are looking at Iraq, and believe me, the Iraqi events are broadcast into Iran daily, and they're paying any attention to the events in Iraq, they would, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to conclude that liberation American way, occupation and destruction of the state would result into rather chaotic condition instead of bringing about liberty and democracy. Having said that, Iran has been on the list of axis of evil for now 2 years, and the U.S. has been constantly threatening Iran with strikes, regime change, etc., etc. And I think people in the country are getting kind of used to this. I'm not saying they're becoming numb, but in a guarded way, they are going about their lives and living their lives while they keep hearing these threats coming their way.
Well, prior to the United States' intervention in Iraq next door, it seemed that the Iranian people, particularly the young and the women who represent the vast majority, were thoroughly fed up with the mullahs. There was this expectation that the reform leadership of Khatami was going to... They have kept having elections, but nothing was done. And I guess, in retrospect, Khatami was just window dressing for the conservatives. He had no real power.
I disagree with that. First of all, we must pause and examine what we mean by fed up by the mullahs. Iranian people, when they were given a chance to vote and voice their opinion through ballot, they voiced their opinion against the current regime. I agree with you. Up to 80% of the electorate basically voted for people who wanted to change the system. So in that sense, you're correct. But in the sense that, and the reform movement, which began with the presidency of Khatami, clearly was not able to deliver on its key elements of its program. But to say that Khatami was window dressing, I think, is a little bit underestimating it. And to say that the people in Iran are totally against this regime and the regime has no social base is also not looking at the picture in its totality. The regime does have a aggressive, militant social base, 10-15%, which is a minority, a clear minority, but a very muscular minority.
Well, actually, I was going to say something else, which was that the regime, even if its power is much greater than the expectations of the 80%, it has proven to be, and that I believe there's a lot of disillusionment amongst the young.
I agree with you on that.
And that they're turning to drugs and to sort of social protests via dress, etc. But they don't seem to have any real power. But it seems to me that if this movement that one of the things that undercut this movement was the intervention in Iraq of the United States next door, that this has had the reverse effect, and this, of course, connects to what we're talking about. If there's a preemptive strike on the part of Israel and the United States or one or the other or both together, it will further drive the people into the embrace of the mullahs. Now, let's start with the first premise. Did the intervention in Iraq with the United States Army right next door undercut the opposition and drive the people further into the clutches of the mullahs?
Well, I wouldn't say clutches of the mullahs, but you must understand that Iranians are pretty patriotic people. And when the Iraq made a mistake of attacking Iran back in 1980, Iranians basically lined up and united, lined up behind the regime to defend the country. This Iranian patriotism and goes back to Iran before Islam, Iran with Islam, Iran as a nation state, as an empire, as a country, which has been around since the dawn of history. And people have some sort of an idea of their own existence and of their own history. So one might dislike a regime, one might dislike a government, one might dislike a way of a country being managed, but one may still defend that country and that government when an external enemy is threatening to basically throw everything into this chaotic tailspin, which is what happened in Iraq. So while many people may have been happy about how and swiftly Saddam Hussein was toppled in 21 days, those very same people are now looking at Iraq and seeing the death and destruction that came in this aftermath. Would people desire a regime change in Iran at that cost? That's the question. Would people determine that the cost does not justify the action? It's just too expensive, and that they have to find their own internal mechanisms to change the regime rather than have a much larger state come out from outside and knock the Islamic State down.
And where is does the Iranian, if you can poll the Iranian people in any kind of accurate way, where does their feelings about the United States rest at this point? Because I understood with a big diaspora, particularly here in Los Angeles, there's a substantial Iranian diaspora, that there was a lot of cultural influence coming back and forth between the United States and Iran, none of which is welcomed by the mullahs, but nevertheless, because of the internet, etc., and satellites, it's just happening. So, where does the sense of goodwill towards the United States reside? Given what you've just said, that they're looking at this disaster in Iraq next door. They've seen evidence of the Americans torturing, which has been apparently devastatingly detrimental to the United States, not particularly in the Middle East, but also in the rest of the world.
Well, first of all, Iran has a vibrant middle class, educated, westward-looking which existed before the revolution and continues to exist today, and it has re-established and kind of is growing in numbers and in economic power. This modern middle class is where you find the most friendly people toward Western culture, Western music, or the LA subculture, Iranian subculture that you just talked about. But in the more general sense, Iranian people, I think, are among the most friendly people toward the United States in the whole Middle East, with the exception of Israel, maybe. And which is an irony. The governments which are supported by the U.S. and upheld by the U.S., Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, have a very much anti-American sentiment among the population. While a government like Iran, which has not been dominated by the U.S. for the past 25 years and has actually confronted the United States, calling it the Great Satan, has a population which is very friendly toward the United States. Having said that, again, I do not think this will translate automatically toward friendliness toward the U.S. government and its military action against Iran. One may like a country, one may like a people, one may like a culture other than one's own, but one may not like to be bombed into Stone Age by that other culture.
And if Seymour Hersh's article is accurate, and of course the Pentagon and the White House have done their best to discredit it, he's suggesting that that there have already been U.S. reconnaissance teams in there looking for these underground facilities where the Iranians allegedly are developing nuclear and other weapons. And he also went on to suggest that the Pentagon planners in the White House, the neoconservatives in the White House, have a delusion, as they clearly demonstrated in Iraq, where they thought that the Iraqi people would welcome the United States conquerors as the Parisians did in World War II. The notion is that if the United States or Israel struck, got rid of the nuclear weapons, that the mullahs would be seen as a paper tiger and that the people would rise up against them.
Well, there are two things to be said about this. First of all, I think what Cy Hersh is saying, and I hear from other sources, no matter how the U.S. government is trying to discredit him, is correct.
Well, he usually is. He always tends out to be.
He usually is. And, you know, recently, I'm sure you know, the CIA was kind of purged from elements who were against U.S. policy in the Middle East. Many top-level operatives were retired. And I think these people with a lot of information came out, and it is not a coincidence that Cy Hersh all of a sudden has all these sources.
Well, he's always had those top-level sources, frankly.
But there are people who are now more willing to talk.
Sure.
With more detailed information. And the fact that during the past 2 months, American planes have been intruding into Iranian airspace, I think suggests that they're testing Iranian defenses. And if this can complement the commando reconnaissance inside Iran. So I think there is truth to this, and it is very, very serious, and I hope the Iranian government and Iranian defense establishment takes this very, very seriously and begins to prepare for such apparent attack without really showing all its cards and telling the Americans what they are going to do in retaliation. That is something for the American military to guess, not to know beforehand. On the other hand, on your second question, or your second point, I think it's rather ironic that none of the lessons of Iraq is being properly learned and looked upon, and yet they are going to another project, which is called Iran. The people in Iraq did not really come out and showed their joy about the American invasion force. They have not shown their joy about American occupation. And the task of reestablishing an Iraqi state has proven almost impossible, very difficult, if not impossible, and yet the policymakers are turning their attention to Iran and basically arguing along the same line, and that this is going to happen, and how it's going to happen, well, God knows. My point is that once you basically fail to learn lessons from your experiences, you keep going, making similar mistakes. And I think in the case of Iran and the U.S., that is a major, major misunderstanding of Iran's internal issues. Even Senator Biden told Condoleezza Rice, you know, you think by attacking military targets in Iran, you're going to resolve, you're going to have people revolting against the mullahs and toppling them. That's fantasy. I agree, it is fantasy. But if you ask me, thinking that they can topple Saddam Hussein and create democracy in Iraq was a fantasy too. That fantasy is showing to be a nightmare, and yet no lessons are being learned from it.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Monsieur Behrous, who's a professor of Middle East history at San Francisco State University, and we're talking about Vice President Cheney's remarks a few days ago suggesting that Iran was on the top of the United States' hit list, and that that Israel may strike first, and there's nothing that we can do about it. And some analysts suggested in retrospect that this was a way to put pressure on the Europeans to be more active in their diplomacy. But nevertheless, it's obviously not playing well in Iran, and as we're discussing, it would be counterproductive to attack Iran if you think that that's going to bring about a revolution against the mullahs. It's likely to have the opposite effect. What's going on vis-a-vis the Iranians in Iraq? I recently spoke with the former New York Times correspondent who's in the region, Yusuf Ibrahim, who said that the Iranians were actively positioning themselves inside the Shia areas of Iraq.
Well, it's only natural for Iran to do that. Many Iranians and Iraqi Shias have intermarried, particularly among the clergy.
And Sistani, of course, grew up and lived in Iran, did he not?
Sistani is an Iranian.
He's an Iranian, and he's likely to be the new de facto leader after this election.
Not so much, no, because you know Sistani comes from a school of clerical thought that basically says that the clergy should not get involved directly in politics or in governing of a country, that they should stay on the sideline and attend to their seminary schools and be moral leaders for society. This school was very different than the school that Ayatollah Khomeini came from, and basically suggested that the clergy should actually grab political power and take over the state. So there are two different schools of thought within the clergy, and Sistani's school is opposed to the Islamic leaders and the way they are ruling Iran. Having said that, there are two other major political parties among the Shias in Iraq, both of them very close to Iran, both of them allies of Iran, and they both are supporting Sistani and the American effort to hold an election. This is the Supreme Council of Islamic Revolution of Iraq, and then the Al-Dawah Party. And they are the ones who basically brokered a peace between Muqtada al-Sadr, the third major player, Shia player, and the Americans, and brought him in line behind the elections. Listen, most of the soldiers which attacked Fallujah alongside the American military were the Shias. Most of the 120,000 Iraqi security forces that Condoleezza Rice talked about during her confirmation hearing are Shias. Some of them are Kurds, but they're mostly Shias. So Shias are basically lining up behind the effort to hold the election and to create a legitimate Iraqi government. And Iran, it would not have been able to, they would not have had it this way if Iran was not behind it. So Iran is actually for having this election, for having the Shias participate, for a very simple reason. If the elections are held, Shias will win, and the idea that a democratic Iraq will be very friendly to the United States and the U.S. policy I think will begin to unravel.
Well, the first thing that is likely to, people like Brent Scowcroft suggesting is likely to happen is that the Sunni, for whom the writing is on the wall, will strike back. And there are, if, you know, if they boycott the elections and that they're not considered to be legitimate and it's a sweep for the Shia, that could well be the beginning of a civil war.
Indeed, indeed.
And where will what would Iran would there then be the main military bulwark for the Shia, would they not, under those conditions?
Well, under those conditions, a Shia government elected by the majority of Iraqi people is trying to keep the integrity of the country. And are you telling me an Islamic Republic in Iran would help them? Yes, they would.
Of course.
That makes a lot of sense.
It makes a lot of sense, and then you got to add to that who would come to the aid of the Sunni,
yes.
The Saudis. Then, and
this is why the whole thing is a big mess.
Right.
And while this mess has not been even sorted out, they had not even begun to sort it out. They are thinking about attacking and creating yet another mess in the neighboring Iran.
Well, on that note, I thank you for joining us, and we should do a follow up because clearly. There's mischief afoot there in the White House, and this is the blind leading the obedient, I would say. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking with Mazia Behrouz, who's a professor of Middle East history at San Francisco State University. And now I'm speaking with Michael Sells, who's a professor of religion at Haverford College, the author of Approaching the Quran and The New Crusades, Constructing the Muslim Enemy. And Michael, the Washington Post International Edition has done an extensive article on the resurgence of Islam in Syria, a secular state run by the Baathists. And apparently, it's the failure of secularism in a lot of these countries like Egypt, Iraq, and Syria that is leading the young to embrace Islam and causing problems for the Baathists. I mean, it's an irony, is it not, that the United States is actually breaking secular regimes in the Middle East, vis-a-vis the Palestinians, their attacks on the Syrians, or their pressure on the Syrians, and the breaking up of Iraq.
This has been going on since really 1967, when the United States decided to ally itself with Saudi Arabia in trying to bring down the secularist ideology of Jabal Abdel Nasser in Egypt. And began in various indirect ways supporting the Muslim Brotherhood and the Saudi efforts to propagate an anti-secularist international Islamic ideology. And even in the beginning stages of Hamas, the United States and Israel had formed policies that put all the pressure on the secularist PLO and to the benefit of Hamas, because they saw the secularists as their primary enemy. And it is surprising, I think, that this policy has continued after the Cold War, when its original rationale, which was any enemy of the Soviets or of leftism is a friend of ours, would seem no longer to apply. But it has continued and even strengthened to the point where in the last several months, there are constant suggestions out of Washington with people associated with the administration that we should attack or destabilize Syria. And of course, if we did, I don't know of any other force that could fill that vacuum except for the resurgent Islamist groups in Syria.
And the same would be true of a coup in Egypt, Jordan. The Muslim Brotherhood would get rid of this. Would be what would replace these secular governments.
Yes, I don't think that the United States is serious about reforming those governments to the extent that they would have open elections, because those governments, at least in Egypt, would almost certainly lose and lose to Islamist parties. Someone, I think, accurately characterized the appeal of Islamist parties as the clean government parties, That is, the corruption has been so horrific and the oppression that goes along with it over so long. And the Islamist groups who have ground grassroots support in localities, and one thing about them is that they're not looking to enrich themselves in the way that the government, secularist governments have done, has given them that sense of clean government. So it's almost by default the alternative.
So then, therefore, Michael Sells, President Bush's inauguration address, where he says our security depends upon the liberty of others, where he called for the spread of liberty, particularly in the Middle East, so he's on the same page as these Islamists who want clean government.
Right, and I think what scares me is actually that I'm very concerned that the administration is so desperate to change the subject from Iraq and to give the sense that it's progressing, it's waging a war that is winning and that there are exciting new fronts, that it really is considering destabilizing the government of Syria. And the government of Syria, if that's destabilized, all of Syria and Lebanon would be in the kind of chaos there is in Iraq. And the irony is that they've told Syria, basically the month after the invasion of Iraq, when it looked like everything was going easily, they said to Syria, you're next. As soon as we finish up here, you're next. And then now they're telling Syria that they want Syria to stop allowing insurgents to come in across the Syrian border into Iraq. But if they've told Syria that as soon as they finish up in Iraq successfully, they're going to destabilize Syria, they've given Syria an
somewhat of a mixed message. That's what we call a mixed message.
I'm astounded by these constant comments that come out about Syria.
Right.
I see all of this is about really Israel and Palestine. The whole policy is based on it. And it is a frightening thing because all of the world now is getting drawn in, as Bush says, you're either on our side or against us, into this Israel-Palestine-centered kind of global vision of struggle.
Well, but last week, Michael Sells, I had a former CIA covert officer, the first woman Arabist. She was in there for quite some time and was working on the Israeli-Palestinian account. And she said, in response to some of the callers who had the anti-Israel bias, basically saying, look, you know, the Israelis recognize what a mess the United States has made in Iraq. That's why it was reported earlier by Cy Hirsch that Mossad is actively involved in the Kurdish north of Iraq to do damage control, and that if Iraq becomes a failed state, then the Islamists will pour through Jordan, which is a very frail state, essentially propped up by the CIA. And that's why the Israelis are now concerned about their border with Jordan. And of course, it gets back to what we talked about earlier, that the two peace treaties that Israel has with Jordan and with Egypt are very much in their interests.
Absolutely, and I can imagine that the Israeli government is very dismayed about the situation in Iraq. It affects them most directly. The other thing, of course, that was the big bombshell this weekend was Dick Cheney stating that Israel might have to bomb the Iranian nuclear facilities. And to state that publicly is basically a public green light for that.
We just got through speaking with an Iranian scholar on that subject and pointing out, of course, that it was counterintuitive in terms of if you want to sever the Iranian people from the mullahs, this is about the worst possible way to go about it.
Yes, I think that would set back that that effort, which I would see as generational,
right,
and is going to happen eventually unless it's set back, I think that definitely would set it back.
Well, let's just touch, though, on the broader thesis, and particularly the nature of your book, The New Crusades, Constructing the Muslim Enemy, in terms of President Bush's somewhat evangelical proclamation in his second inauguration.
Right.
Obviously, we talked about the irony that people like the Saudis and the Egyptians don't like the idea that the president is calling for their removal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, where do you think the real evangelist and the realpolitik part company here? I mean, what's the mix here?
Well, I don't really try to read Bush's personal mind. I actually think we're all very complex, and I think he probably has various impulses. Some of them, even though many of my friends are very critical, I think some of them are actually helpful in the sense that it's more open. The evangelical aspect is more open. It's always there, I think, in American politics. And here, it doesn't hide itself as much. What worries me is the apparatus behind the statements. That the United States has a mission to bring peace and democracy. It goes all the way back through American speeches. It's kind of what you're expected to say in a speech. It's a performative kind of gospel. You're proclaiming the good news, and you're going to bring it to the world. Behind that is the influence of the religious right upon American foreign policy, which I think is very strongly based on their readings of the Bible and their readings of Israel-Palestine policy through the Bible. And if that becomes dominant, to the extent that some people believe, and I'm inclined to believe this myself, that even if Israelis and Palestinians could come to an agreement, like they almost came to in 2000, on their own, I'm not so sure now that the dominant political forces in the United States would accept that.
Well, they're doing their best. The Tom DeLays of this world are doing their best to frustrate any agreement. They're on the
right
side of the ultra-Orthodox and the settler movement.
That's right.
And these evangelicals are funding, for example, they fund the demonstrators. They pay for the buses that bring the settlers in to picket and scream at Sharon and put signs on the wall saying, well, you'll end up the same way as Rabin did, you know.
Yes, and it is ironic, I think, to think back that when the Begin government bombed the nuclear facility in Iraq, the first person that Begin called was not President Reagan. It was Jerry Falwell. So even back then, the connection was very strong between that part of Israeli Likud politics and the religious right.
It's also worth noting that when Netanyahu came for the meetings that Clinton brokered with Arafat, the evening before the meetings that he took place, I think it was at Y, I can't remember where it was now, that Netanyahu met with Falwell and did a fundraiser with him.
That's right.
And Falwell at the time was selling a videotape for $49.95 saying that Clinton had murdered his best friend, Vince Foster. So there's no question about that connection. It's also worth noting that when the Israelis did attack the Iraqi nuclear reactor preemptively, that was on the eve of the final meeting that Begin had with the Egyptian leader, who was subsequently assassinated. So it was also a way of emasculating the Egyptian, who was later killed by Bin Laden's people, or Zahawi's people, you know.
So that's one of my concerns about the geopolitical situation is the kind of movement of the United States foreign policy into a biblically based aggressive policy in the Middle East that dictates everything else. On the opposite side, there's a movement within Islamic radical groups to see things almost in exactly the same terms of good versus evil, a global war, but just to reverse who's the good and who's the evil. And these two rhetorics tend to mimic one another. So when I say constructing the Muslim enemy, I don't mean that there aren't Muslim enemies of the United States out there. They are, and they're very aggressive. But this mode of thinking about is about world conflict as good versus evil, and putting Islam on one side and the United States on the other, has a dynamic in which it creates, it helps inflame and create the conflict that it says is inevitable anyway.
So you see a symbiosis then between the cult of death in Islam, represented by bin Laden, and suicide, and this what's loosely called the jihadi movement, and the cult of death in Christianity, calling for the end of the world and
Yes, I think there's a one clear difference, which is the Islamic ideologues, the real radicals who glorify death in martyrdom operations against the West, make this very clear, that they see life as fleeting, and they see their chance for martyrdom now, and they're not worried about any comfort in the meantime for them or anybody else. Whereas I see American apocalypticism in this way as wanting to have our cake and eat it too. That is, we want a comfortable life, we want peace, we want to see our children and grandchildren grow up on the one hand. But on the other hand, there's a national fascination with biblical apocalypse and with biblical stories. As one preacher said on the TV today, we're not worried about the conflict because we've read the book and read the ending of the book. And if you're thinking that the ending of the book is a return of Jesus and a rapture of people up to heaven, it's a pretty wonderful ending. But it is a death cult in the sense that if one is applying it to contemporary politics, then there's a tug between whether we really want to see our grandchildren grow up, or we really would rather just be raptured up to Jesus in our own lifetime and never have to die ourselves. And I do see these two death cults as pushing one another dangerously. And the hopeful thing is, I think that they're powerful images and they powerfully affect us, but I think that there's a lot of human beings that have a commitment to life across religious boundaries, who can see the human being in people across religious boundaries. And if it weren't for them, I think we'd be in a lot worse situation.
Well, that is a movement that is yet to be mobilized, it seems to me, whereas the other movement, the death cult movement, has proven itself to be highly mobilized. They were the core support that got President Bush elected. And we still don't know, thanks to our feckless opposition in this country, we still don't know whether, and the feckless press, we don't know whether President Bush shares the belief of his core supporters.
I think that the movement of those people who reject bipolar global warfare as a vision of life is powerful, but it almost by nature does not get news attention. And so it's happening all the time. It's working all the time. I think it saved Bosnia from catastrophe. I think it saved India from catastrophe several times when Islamic radicals or Hindu radicals have tried to foment religious war there. It has been Hindus and Muslims across communitarian lines who have saved one another, who have helped one another, who have refused to buy into the war ideology. And even though there have been moments where that war ideology has succeeded, they've saved much worse. But you're right. I think that these other movements, they capture the imagination, and especially televised media is a powerful forum for them, and they've learned how to manipulate it brilliantly.
But again, nobody's been able to smoke the president out. I did speak to one reporter who asked Scott McClelland whether the president share his foreign policy is guided by the idea of the end of times and the need for Israel to provoke Armageddon. And there was a deadly silence, and Scott McClelland said, I'll get back to you on that, and of course never did, and that reporter hasn't been particularly welcome at the White House ever since.
Yeah, well, my feeling is that it's that human beings are complex, and that there's a part of all of us that these dramatic stories that promise a clear end, a clear victory, and eternal life must appeal to, and that the other part of us that sees all the people around us who would be hurt if we went plunging off for that vision in the wrong way is in competition with that self that is attracted to that vision. And I'm not sure from one moment to the next whether any human being is secure or really knows which of the sides of that human being is dominant. And that's why I think it's important to have a political culture that can talk about these things seriously, because we can't rely on Bush. Even if he thought self-consciously he were one way or the other, the subconscious might be working in different ways.
But without being unfair to President Bush, anybody who divides is going down that path. You know, he is a divider. He said he was going to be a uniter and not a divider. And the whole point about the, I don't know whether, I saw recently a group of religious figures on Larry King on CNN talking about the tsunami and whether God had forsaken the humanity because of allowing such a terrible thing to happen. Mm-hmm. And there was a Buddhist, a rabbi, and a mullah, and a priest, Catholic priest or monk or something, and then there was this guy from the Southern Baptists, and none of them had anything, but they, you know, basically nobody felt that they really knew the answers except the Southern Baptist. He had all the answers, and all these people, they died because they didn't know Jesus, you know, and by implying it was their own fault. And the other people on the panel were clearly outraged by the hubris. So there is a sort of hubristic division here and of course it's also true in Islam. They talk about the rest as infidels and unbelievers. So anybody that divides, to my mind, is taking us to hell.
Well, I think the problem is that all of our religions, and I'm speaking just from the point of view that I've tried to look at these from the point of view of the way religions affect us, all of our religions are uniters in the sense that they can bring about powerful senses of interior community among believers. They can get believers to help one another, to sacrifice their lives from one another, to really be less egoistic in dealing with one another. But they do that in part through giving extraordinarily powerful visions of cosmic conflict. So they unite by dividing on some level. And one of the things that I think all the religious traditions now after the Cold War, especially religious leaders, have to do is start talking about how we can make sure that the power of these religious traditions to unite by fighting the enemy does not end up reproducing itself in simple human warfare. And I think it's a terrible problem built into the structure of religions that religions have never confronted adequately until the present day. And it's something that religions need to sit down, and all religions have to get together at the table, because if you pick out one religion, it gets defensive and it won't listen to these questions. The same hard questions have to be asked of all religions.
Well, Mark, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll talk again.
Thank you very much.
I thank you for joining us. Michael Sells is Professor of Religion at Haverford College and the author of The New Crusades, Constructing the Muslim Enemy. I thank the engineer, Mark Maxwell, and the producer, Lewis Vandenberg, and the assistant producer, Carol Coote.